The Guardian.
Boris Johnson has been struck down with coronavirus and is working from his self-isolation bunker. But NHS workers are struggling on without testing or protective equipment. I'm Rowena Mason, Deputy Political Editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
Hi folks, I want to bring you up to speed with something that's happening today, which is that I've developed mild symptoms of the coronavirus, that's to say a temperature and a persistent cough, and on the advice of the Chief Medical
Officer. One by one, many people working in Westminster have had to self-isolate after showing symptoms of having COVID-19. First we had the Prime Minister, followed shortly by Health Secretary Matt Hancock, and then the Chief Medical Officer, Professor Chris Whitty, who we've become so accustomed to seeing in our daily press briefings. On Monday, it was then reported that the Prime Minister's senior advisor, Dominic Cummings, was also displaying symptoms. And as we've heard time and time again, this coronavirus doesn't discriminate, and our very own Heather Stewart knows more about this than most. She was meant to be presenting this week, but she too has started showing symptoms, so here's hoping she's better soon and she'll be back in front of the mic in no time. With Boris Johnson expecting to be out of self-isolation by Friday, what can we expect next from Number 10 in response to this escalating crisis? And as most of us stay indoors, NHS workers continue to implore the government to better equip them for the fight ahead, whether that be in the form of proper testing or providing protective gear. So can Boris Johnson guarantee safer working conditions for the country's frontline staff? And in other news, it might seem like a lifetime ago when it started, but this Saturday the Labour leadership campaign will come to an end. I'll chat to the former head of policy for the Labour Party to get his thoughts on what has been a long, long journey and what the future looks like for his party. And lastly, you could be forgiven for forgetting about a little thing called Brexit. But later on, we hear from The Guardian's Brussels correspondent, Jennifer Rankin, about how the UK and EU seem to be getting on in what is their first big post-Brexit test for consensus. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, I'm recording this episode live from my living room, having stolen a few quiet minutes away from my two-year-old. I haven't seen my Westminster colleagues in person for a couple of weeks now, so I thought I'd call up The Guardian's political correspondent, Kate Proctor, to see how she's finding reporting on the lobby from afar. Hello, Kate. How are you doing? How are you finding working at home?
Yeah, it's taken a bit of getting used to. I'm working in a tiny little room full of junk that no one normally comes into, but we're all making it work. I'm in a house share in Hackney, so there's lots of us here all working from home.
Wow, that sounds pretty crowded. Are you managing to concentrate?
There's a lot of Zoom calls, a lot of teleconferencing, a lot of video calls all going on around me. Sometimes, you know, if I just need to write an article quite fast, I just put up some music and just try and block everything else out.
I won't ask you if you're still in your pyjamas.
Well, I am.
Well, we are relying on technology a lot at the moment, so even just to get this podcast out. But you had a particularly tech-focused day on Sunday, didn't you, when you were working from home and you had to dial into the Prime Minister's press conference?
Yeah, so the daily press conference is happening. Various different ministers are taking it on because Boris Johnson is in isolation. And the way that journalists are doing it now is we phone into Downing Street from home, and we have a little practice, a little rehearsal, and then we go through to ask the question live. But you are live on TV and you're from your living room, and oh, it was so complicated. I had to try and angle my phone so that I was in the correct shot, and I was balancing it on books and then a shoebox and then a couple of gin glasses, just to, whatever I had around me, just basically to get my phone at the right angle. And then I had to sit in position basically for about an hour. I couldn't really move, just waiting and waiting for my question to be called. And then the minister got the order all mixed up and missed me off. And then he eventually got there at the end. We had someone from Downing Street who was signalling using sign language to the minister to say, you know, you've got one more question to go. Make sure you take Kate from The Guardian, which he did. So it was fine. But honestly, such a different procedure from just turning up and being there in person and just switching your dictaphone on and asking a question.
You didn't have some artfully arranged intellectual looking books behind you like most of the ministers seem to do at the moment?
I'm really, really not into that. Like, obviously, it's really hard not to make your home look like you're in a hostage situation. You know, I live in a shared house. Like, there's a lot of white walls because that's just what it's like in a rental. But I mean, I tried to put a nice picture in the background, but I mean, I'd have to go back to university books to go and try and drag out the last really impressive thing that I read. So no, I'm keeping it real with a picture.
Well, it makes for a good story, doesn't it? And we don't really have that much going on in our lives apart from work. And it's a bit lonely doing this separately, isn't it? How are you finding it, like, from that point of view?
It's hard as a journalist. I'm sure you're finding the same thing, because you really rely on face-to-face interaction. To be honest, if an idea is not working out great, it's so helpful to be able to bounce that off someone else or just see that reaction from somebody, that it's a good idea or a bad idea. So I think I found that really hard, because we've got such a nice office in Westminster. You know, it's always busy. There's always people coming in and out. And I have missed that for sure. I think it's harder to get really, really motivated just because you're not seeing people and you just need that energy to feed off.
But we might not be in the office together, but we are still working hard to cover what's going on in Westminster. And Dominic Raab and Michael Gove have stood in for the likes of Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock at this special daily press conference. Have you been impressed by either of those two figures, or Robert Jenrick, or Rishi Sunak? Who's performing the best at the lectern at the moment, Kate?
I mean, I think it's no surprise, really. I think Rishi Sunak has done particularly well. I feel like probably Raab, considering that he's, you know, second in command and he's the person to step up should the Prime Minister become more poorly, which it doesn't look like that's the case at all. But I thought Raab was very wooden and it didn't really quite connect. And I know it's so hard for them because they are talking to a screen, but I wasn't really very impressed with his whole demeanour. But Michael Gove is someone who's very, very used to doing it. But also, I'd say he's the king of diverting a question into something that he wants to talk about. And I think for Gove, and I think for Jenrick as well, I think they have not given very satisfactory answers whatsoever on testing. And I think the patience of the country, you know, is running quite thin. And I think unless they start giving much more fulsome and really what feels like honest answers about testing, then it doesn't really matter what they say now in the rest of their performance when they're doing the press conference.
Well, let's just move on to that topic of testing. There's still a lot of confusion over testing kits and why more NHS workers are not being tested, why there is a capacity to test 11,000 people or up to 13,000 people potentially now. But still, daily levels are running at 8,000. And over the weekend, it was less than 5,000 people in comparison to countries like Germany, which have tested 70,000 a day. So Matt Hancock's now asked hospitals with any spare capacity at all to test their NHS workers. But critics are still saying that the government was too slow on testing. And do you think that critics have a point there, Kate?
Absolutely. I feel like every day that goes by, we ask a similar set of questions at those press conferences about when are you going to roll out testing? And they say as soon as possible. And I think over the last few days, they started to say, oh, we're short of a chemical reagent that we need to make these tests work. And then saying it's better to have a good test than something that has been thrown together very quickly. And that's, you know, that's what's coming from the medical advisors. But of course, it feels so slow. And you can see what's happened in Germany and South Korea. And it's constantly put to ministers, why are we behind Germany? And I do not think that we're getting very good answers. And I think there's been a lot of patience so far with the government and the way that they've run things, and a lot of support and a lot of buy-in to these crazy, crazy rules that we're all having to live under for our own safety. But I think unless they can start giving much more honest answers on testing, then they're going to be in a lot of difficulty. They say there's a global shortage of some of the things that are needed to create a test. But why were we not doing this earlier? Why were we not on the front foot and ordering things that we needed months and months ago?
And is there a possibility that there is not an ideological, more of a strategic decision behind this, not to put so much emphasis on testing like some other countries have done? We seem to be putting a lot of our hopes on a future antibody test, which tells you whether you've already had the disease, rather than the current test that we've got, which tells you if you are a live case of the disease, which is only limited to patients in hospitals and some NHS workers.
So yes, I think they are aiming for what they would believe to be a gold standard of testing, which is knowing that, you know, you've had it, and then you can get back to work. And that's the way that you unlock this shutdown, restrictive situation that we're in. But it just doesn't feel right. I mean, when the UK looks to be behind other countries, it's quite an unsettling feeling. And so much about the rhetoric behind Brexit and everything that's led up to this period of time is about Britain being leagues ahead in terms of being a country and being an established nation. And we don't need the support of other countries. We can go things on our own independently. Yet really, I think this has just shown that there are other countries out there that can tackle things in a better way than we are at the moment. And I think that's got to be quite a difficult thing for Downing Street to swallow, which might be why, you know, they're persisting with their own form of strategy in testing.
Another area that the government's come under some criticism for is their approach to repatriating British nationals trapped abroad. And we reported yesterday the government had launched a £75 million rescue mission to bring back an estimated 300,000 British people stranded. But figures seen by The Guardian have also showed that Germany has chartered 30 times more rescue flights than the UK, flying home more than 40,000 travellers from across the world. So will the government's latest spending announcement be enough, do you think, Kate?
I think the message that the government gave out on this was, you know, to all intents and purposes, try and get home yourself, try and get a commercial flight. And if you can't, you know, then we'll help you. And they've announced this investment. Again, Germany is leading the way. So this is on testing and this is on repatriations as well. You know, Germany's putting in so much more money to try and get their citizens home. So we'll have to see where we are in a few weeks when these flights have been deployed and people are able to come back to the UK or not. But again, it doesn't feel like Britain is doing, you know, everything that it can to bring people back. Or unfortunately, because you've got that very clear comparison just with another country, people might feel as though the UK isn't trying as hard. But I mean, I'm sure the Foreign Office would entirely disagree and say they're putting in, you know, all the resources they can to get people back home again.
And we've been through some of the areas where the government's finding it tricky. Is there anything that you think they've got right in this, Kate? What about the ventilators having sent out a plea for manufacturers to make tens of thousands more?
Of course, I think the ventilators and the fact that they use these manufacturers very quickly to create ventilators, and they're going to come online, which is great government speak, but they're going to be put into place next week. I think that's a really amazing effort. You know, you might have these companies that have never turned their hand to making ventilators before, suddenly being able to roll out these extremely complex bits of kit. I think that's really impressive. I'm also impressed with the field hospitals, with the NHS Nightingale. It's kind of terrifying to see those images of these very expansive halls just full of beds, but that clearly is the capacity that the government and the NHS think is needed. So, you know, I am reassured to see that those are in place. And I think in terms of social distancing, and, you know, I do think people have really got the message. It's so, so quiet. I mean, I live in Hackney. It's normally just absolutely heaving. And at night, I can't hear a thing. You know, there are no cars going past the window at all. And I think that's been very effective. And I think the government has got its message across and people are staying at home. So, I mean, we can't deny testing is going to stand out in all of this as a huge, huge issue. But I think in terms of some of the other things that have happened, I'd say the government's done a pretty good job.
Well, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks so much for chatting, Kate. And I don't know when I'm going to see you again, but hopefully it won't be before too long.
Thanks, Rowena. All right. See you soon, hopefully.
See you soon. Bye. That was The Guardian's political correspondent, Kate Proctor. After the break, Jennifer Rankin updates us on the relationship between the UK and the EU. And I speak to Andrew Fisher, the former head of policy for the Labour Party, about what Saturday's leadership contest might bring and where his party goes from here once a team takes their spot at the helm. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Rowena Mason. Now, it was less than 3 months ago when Brexit seemed to be the talk of the town, but since the world became preoccupied with trying to limit the spread of COVID-19, Brexit talks were put on the back burner. This has many in Europe suggesting that the British government would have no choice but to ask for an extension to the transition period at the end of the year. Number 10 has rejected this call, saying over and over that the 31st of December exit date is enshrined in UK law. Despite these circumstances, there are still hopes that Brexit talks could kick off again soon, maybe with leaders connecting virtually. The Guardian's Brussels correspondent, Jennifer Rankin, has been looking at how the EU is responding to the coronavirus crisis, how EU leaders feel the UK's response has been, and whether or not this first post-Brexit crisis is showing signs that the two sides really can get along when it comes to negotiation. She has this report.
Well, I think like almost everywhere in Europe, everyone is working from home. The whole sort of business of the EU is really ground to a, well, not ground to a halt, but there are no longer physical meetings taking place. So MEPs who are usually based anyway in their home country, they are not coming to Brussels anymore unless they happen to be Belgian MEPs. So there was a session of the European Parliament last week where maybe only about half a dozen MEPs attended, or at least that's what I could see on the live stream footage. For the first time, MEPs were able to vote remotely, which was a first for the European Parliament. That's never been allowed before. So by and large, everyone's teleworking, doing a lot of conference calling. As journalists, we're watching a lot of press conferences online and filing our questions via WhatsApp. So everybody's working very differently. When looking at the EU, it's important always to look at member states, because the EU is only ever as strong as its member countries allow it to be. And we've seen some member states that at first really were just looking out for themselves in this crisis. That's certainly the criticism from the EU institutions in Brussels. Maybe around a month ago, Germany and France both put export bans on the export of medical equipment such as masks and protective clothing for medical workers. And that was really seen as a very unhelpful, uncooperative thing to do for other EU member states, because not all countries are producing this kind of equipment.
Come mai in Italia così tanti casi che vengono scoperti peraltro tutti in un tratto?
There was also at an earlier phase in the crisis, when it had really only hit Italy, Italy activated an EU mechanism calling for help. It's called the Civil Protection Mechanism. And it's basically like sort of sending up a flag, a distress call, and saying, other member states, please help us. We would like more equipment, more staff. We're desperately running short. And nobody responded to that call. So that caused a lot of unhappiness on the Italian side, and also raised questions about whether the EU member states could be there for each other, especially when China then sent a big consignment of masks to Italy. Has to be said that since then that situation has changed, that member states have started to do more for each other. So Germany and France have both sent supplies to Italy. And also worth adding as well that different EU member states now are taking in some patients from countries that are most stretched. So Germany is treating Italian patients and French patients. Luxembourg as well is also treating some French victims of coronavirus. So there is, you can see more sort of effort to move towards solidarity. But I think right at the very beginning, it did raise questions as to whether the coronavirus was going to sort of split the EU into having these very nationalist, beggar thy neighbour responses, or whether it was going to be something that brings the EU closer together. And when we look at the big picture, the jury is still out on that.
L'épidémie de COVID-19 était peut-être pour certains d'entre vous une idée lointaine. Elle est devenue une réalité immédiate, pressante.
I think initially there was concern about the British approach. We heard reports in the French press that Emmanuel Macron was very worried that the British had taken the so-called herd immunity approach, and he was considering closing the border to UK nationals because he was worried that the virus was going to spread very easily in the UK. That's at least according to the reports in the French media. I've also heard other politicians, MEPs, say that they thought the UK was slow to act. But it's important to say that the UK is not alone in its response, and that the Netherlands has taken a slightly looser approach to lockdown. also Sweden as well, is still allowing shops and bars to remain open. So I think the experiment with trying to control the virus will be a very interesting one to watch. So certainly the UK has come more into line with other EU member states, but it certainly wasn't alone in trying a different, less restrictive approach.
There was some communication confusion. I don't know all the details of that, but I do know, having talked to senior figures in the NHS, that there was not, there's nothing that participating in that scheme would have allowed us to do that we have not been able to do ourselves. And of course,
the UK had the chance to take part in a common procurement scheme with the EU to bulk buy ventilators. So basically, this is a way to get economies of scale, to get medical equipment at a cheaper price and possibly faster than you would otherwise get it as a single member state. And it's worth saying that this was not just about ventilators. In fact, there were four different EU schemes on buying medical equipment that have been set up since the coronavirus crisis began. And the UK remains part of EU structures and has the right to take part in these procurement schemes. However, it emerged when the UK was decided not to take part in the schemes. Initially, the government refused to comment on this. At first, they said, well, we're not taking part in these schemes because we're no longer an EU member state. But then very quickly, that account, which was from number 10, was changed. And they said, well, we just missed an email. We didn't know about these schemes and we didn't get an invitation in time. But a lot of doubts and questions now have been cast on that account. As we reported in the Guardian this week, British officials were present at four internal EU meetings where the issue of these joint procurement schemes was discussed. So as early as the 31st of January, a British official was part of the EU's Health Security Committee meeting on COVID-19, and the issue of joint procurement was raised at that meeting. We also know it was raised at three later meetings. So for the UK to claim that it didn't get an email, it's really stretching our credulity here. It's just unbelievable that there was just one email that it didn't get when clearly officials were taking part in meetings and were informed about these options.
It is important, however, to understand that even if we do achieve such a best-in-class free trade agreement, it will not be business as usual.
Well, Brexit has certainly dropped right down everybody's agenda, but it is still there in the background and the clock is still ticking, that phrase we've all come to know so well. And even before the coronavirus really struck Europe, everybody thought that the timetable for agreeing a future relationship deal was just way too short. And now it just looks even more of an uphill struggle. Last week, there were supposed to be talks between the negotiating teams. They didn't happen. There's supposed to be another round next week in Brussels. That also looks in doubt. And although the British government continues to say they are exploring video conferencing options, that's not such an easy option for these very big negotiations, where you might even in just one session, you can have, say, sort of 30 to 40 people on each side. And that makes it very complicated to organise just one single video call. Added to that, Michel Barnier has said he has coronavirus, and David Frost, the UK's chief negotiator, has gone into self-isolation with symptoms. So the two men leading these talks, they're currently in self-isolation. So now there really is growing pressure on the EU side to extend the talks, because there is the possibility to do that. They can be extended for up to 2 years. But the government continues to say, no, we want to leave the transition period on time so the UK is fully outside all EU structures by 2021. The same bones of contention that have really been, you know, present in these talks, you know, present in the discussion for the last few years are still there. But now the time to resolve them is really becoming extremely short. And the problem is the two sides are just not meeting and having those face-to-face talks to really crunch through the issues. The two sides are miles apart on Brexit, and it's really hard to see how they would square their differences, even if it weren't for this coronavirus crisis, which is now dominating everything and dominating everybody's attention. And when it comes to cooperation on coronavirus, I mean, as I said, so far we haven't seen a great deal of evidence on it. What the EU would hope is that there can be continued cooperation on research in future, so British scientists, British-based scientists, will continue to be working with their European counterparts on finding treatments and vaccines for COVID-19 and other types of influenza. But at the moment, it's really uncertain as to how that can continue, because there's absolutely nothing agreed between the two sides on whether this kind of collaboration will continue in future. And I think if it doesn't, it would really be a loss for both sides when you think about the weight of British science and British research.
The Guardian's Brussels correspondent, Jennifer Rankin there. Now, at the start of the year, Brexit wasn't the only thing being discussed in political circles. The Labour leadership campaign had recently kicked off, and there was a buzz about the place of people wondering who would take over from Jeremy Corbyn. After nearly 4 months, this Saturday, we're poised to find out who Labour Party members deem the most suitable to lead them into the next 4 years as the opposition. So when the party elects its new leader, how should the winner convert his or her triumph into a meaningful way forward for the Labour Party? To answer this and more, I spoke to Andrew Fisher, the former Executive Director of Policy under outgoing leader Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, I've kind of been self-isolating and furloughed myself a bit since I left the Labour Party as an employer in December, because I just wanted a bit of a break, really, after the last 4.5 years. I've been fine. Unfortunately, I'm only recently self-employed, so I'm not eligible for Rishi Sunak's generous scheme, but... There we are.
Before we talk about Saturday, when the new Labour leader is about to be unveiled, we should say a word about the outgoing leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and what his legacy will be. Do you think in 10, 20, 50 years' time, will he be seen as a Labour success story, in your view?
I think it will be mixed, to be honest. I think, obviously, two electoral defeats are going to be the headline that will be looked back on in 50 years' time. But I think for people who actually look a bit more closely, I think there are a number of things that changed about the Labour Party, which obviously it depends what happens next, but will be, I think, an enduring legacy. So I think the size of the Labour Party and the nature of how Jeremy not just changed the Labour Party, but actually changed politics a bit. You know, we were having conversations 5-6 years ago about how young people were disengaged from politics, how political parties were dying out and we needed to consider state funding. Those conversations have kind of stopped now because the Labour Party is the largest political party in Europe. It's got lots of young members. It's got more young people engaged in politics as well. And I think that's quite a success story that will endure. But also there are other things as well, I think, that have changed about the party. The party is, you know, very openly for public ownership now, whereas that had been, you know, on the back burner since, you know, probably Neil Kinnock, really. And it also ended the pandering around immigration as well. And I think the party's got a lot more comfortable at standing up and fighting for things, even if it is a little bit unpopular or seems like it will be unpopular at the time, that will be challenged now. And I think, I hope that campaigning spirit will endure.
And as for Jeremy himself, do you have any idea what he'll do next? Do you think he will take that campaigning spirit and continue with it?
Yeah, that preceded his leadership as well. I mean, he'd been a backbencher for, you know, 30 odd years before he became Labour leader. So he'll go back to the backbenches. He'll continue to be an active constituency MP campaigning on the issues that he cares about most.
And let's look at those running for the top spot, Rebecca Long-Bailey, Lisa Nandy and Keir Starmer. Who have you been most impressed with throughout?
Well, I backed Rebecca Long-Bailey because she's closer to my own politics, but also I think her kind of attempt to frame the conversation around aspirational socialism and what that meant and tried to spell out a little bit of vision, I think, more than the other candidates, impressed me the most. I mean, I've worked with all three within the Labour Party. I have great respect for all three, but I thought Rebecca just about edged it. And I think it is time for a woman leader. I don't think we're going to get one, but I think it is. In fact, it's not about time. It's long past time that Labour had a female leader. So to be fair to Keir Starmer, who I think we all know is going to win on Saturday, his message of, you know, getting over the faction fighting and uniting the party, I think is very powerful and appeals to a lot of people right across the party. I think whichever side of the Labour Party you're on, feel fairly bruised by the last few years.
And Keir Starmer has remained the front runner, as you say, throughout the campaign. If he wins on Saturday, what do you think we should expect to see change in the party? Do you think he will move away from Jeremy's philosophy and style of leadership at all?
I think he'll be a different type of leader, certainly, from Jeremy. He's a, you know, quite a different person from Jeremy. But from what he's said, he's not looking to, you know, kind of rip up the basics of the policy platform. Of course, things will change. Circumstances will change. You know, and any leader has to react to real life event. So, you know, he won't preserve everything in aspic, and nor should he. I mean, the one good thing, I think, is he won't face the same sort of hostility that Jeremy did when he became leader. I don't think he'll get kind of people walking off in a half, resigning, briefing against him immediately, in the same way, at least anyway, or at least I hope not. I think the danger for him is he mustn't make the same sort of mistakes Ed Miliband made, because, you know, we shouldn't get into a kind of technocratic parliamentarianism. I mean, whatever happens at the end of this coronavirus crisis, and whenever it does end, the country is going to be in huge debt. Spending will have gone up. There'll be a lot more people claiming benefits. There'll be more cost to government. The Tories' plans will be ripped up, and they will be looking for somebody to pay for that. And Labour's got to be very strong in making sure it's not the most vulnerable that pay the price. And we were quite weak on that, I think, in those sort of 5 or 6 years after the financial crash, both in government and in opposition, actually. And so I very much hope he is quite strong in that. And I think the way to do that, I mean, he's obviously going to change the shadow cabinet in lots of ways. I mean, not least because John McDonnell, Diane Abbott and a few others have said they want to go to the back benches anyway. But he does need to find a balance, a kind of broad church in a kind of Wilsonian way, so that he does have the range of opinion in there and the range of approaches as well.
Would you expect to see Lisa Nandy and Rebecca Long-Bailey as part of the mix?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he said during the campaign he would have them both in his shadow cabinet and wants to work with them. So, and I think, unlike when Jeremy won, I think both of the candidates are willing to serve in the shadow cabinet as well. And that was that will be a difference, and I think positive as well.
And any other top tips for the shadow cabinet names?
I think he might bring in some people who have been a little bit second tier within the shadow front bench. So people like Nick Thomas-Symonds. And then I suspect a lot of people will stay on, albeit in different roles. So people like Angela Rayner and Richard Bergen, Andy McDonald, I would expect, Jonathan Ashworth, and so on.
And on Saturday, Labour members are going to be voting for their deputy as well. You mentioned Angela Rayner there, who is unfortunately currently self-isolating after developing coronavirus symptoms. But she still looks strongly likely to win the contest. What do you think her role would be in a Labour leadership duo if she wins alongside Starmer?
I think it's, in some ways, really, as deputy, it's one of those things that's kind of negotiated between the leader and the deputy themselves. There's no kind of set template for a deputy leader. It depends what policy brief either Angela wants or Keir wants for Angela, to be honest, because at the moment she's Shadow Education Secretary and has done a great job over the last 4 years, since 2016. But whether she wants to stay on in that role and Keir wants her to stay on in that role, I don't know. Other deputy leaders have wanted to take a more internal party role, and whether, you know, Ian Lavery stays on as party chair and things like that as well.
And understandably, people might not be paying as much attention to the Labour leadership contest as they might have been before this coronavirus crisis hit. But how important do you think it will be to have a strong Labour Party sitting across the Commons from Johnson?
I think it's absolutely vital, because I think if you look at the issues that have been probably highlighted, particularly under Jeremy Corbyn, you know, austerity, the low level of benefits, weak employment rights, insecure housing, the value we place on low paid and migrant workers. I think all of those things that will be in the forefront of the public discussion, because people will have experienced a lot of those things, or the effects of those things, in their lives in a way they wouldn't have done until recently, or a lot more sharply. So the whole coronavirus crisis has thrown into sharp relief a lot of the issues that Jeremy Corbyn was raising. And I think the Labour front bench needs to be very, very hot on kind of raising those things and taking advantage of, I think, a changed public mood.
And we've heard a lot during this coronavirus outbreak that Labour's role is to hold the government to account. But how difficult is that going to be now the government is rolling out quite a few policies that Labour would have pushed to put in place at the election without the pressure of a pandemic? So I'm thinking about nationalising the railways and increasing benefits and massive amounts of money going to the NHS. How is Labour going to have to navigate that over the coming months and years?
So it's twofold. One is, if you look at the measures that have been put in place temporarily for the crisis, it's kind of working out which of those you want to continue and campaigning for those measures to continue where appropriate. And then the second thing is looking at what's changed in society, and people's values, people's experiences have shifted by this. I mean, we don't know what the level of unemployment will be or the level of people on kind of reduced hours will be at the end of this crisis, but it's clearly going to be substantially up on where it was before. The economy was stagnant in the last quarter of 2019. It was weak anyway. Wages were falling for the poorest fifth. I think there's a lot of issues around low pay, job insecurity, housing insecurity that will, as I say, be the things that Labour should really be campaigning on. And I think I wouldn't trust the Conservatives to solve them, because for all the money they've pledged as loans for businesses or wage payments for furloughed workers or self-employed workers, there is still not addressed those fundamental structural problems within the economy that those schemes have sought to kind of ameliorate at best. So I think that that's the kind of key things. And again, like with the railways, does it go back to business as normal once the economy recovers a bit, or once the kind of shutdown is over, and the franchises are allowed to keep ripping us off with the most expensive rail fares in Europe for one of the worst services and most unreliable services? So again, it's kind of looking at those issues and what's really at the heart of people's concerns. And I think Labour can tap into that at the right time. I think trying to be too sharply political at this time, when people are, you know, very anxious about their security, their housing, their income, and about their health and the care of their loved ones, I think would be wrong. And I think Labour's, you know, played it fairly well in that sense. It has got the tone right. But I think after this, it must be very sharply political, because these questions are very sharp political questions.
And you're right, you're quite right. It does seem sort of wrong to talk about it like a sort of opportunity for Labour. But do you think there will be an appetite among the public, much like there was after in the post-war era, for a new emphasis on the importance of public services after this crisis?
I mean, we shouldn't get too carried away with analogies to the Second World War. We're only, you know, kind of 1 week and a day into a lockdown. You know, it's not that substantial yet. But of course, if this does go on for several months, then people will start experiencing, you know, what it's like to live on benefits, what it's like to live on reduced income. Because even if they're in the furloughed scheme, their income's been cut by 20%, which is pretty substantial for most people. There will be a different set of experiences that people have had, and a new value placed on certain jobs that weren't valued enough and have been, you know, paid very low wages for a very long time. And I hope that that brings not an opportunity, but a consciousness in the public that these things need to change, or a renewed consciousness or a heightened consciousness within the public that these things need to change, and people need to be paid decent wages. People should have the right to housing. And we've just seen schemes not fully implemented, and it's patchy, but to get all of the rough sleepers off the streets. Now, if that can be done because of a global health pandemic, surely we can get rough sleepers off the streets just because they're rough sleepers and they shouldn't be sleeping on the streets. I mean, there's a kind of moral argument here that was true before the crisis, but has been heightened by the crisis. So it's not that the crisis is an opportunity. It's more that bringing these things into sharp relief makes more people realise, more people concerned about what's become of our society a bit.
That's all from us this week. To hear more from each Labour leadership candidate and what they propose to offer if elected, Keir Starmer, Rebecca Long-Bailey and Lisa Nandy have all spoken to Anoushka Astana for our flagship daily Today in Focus. Just search for each episode wherever you get your podcasts. And for anyone wanting to hear less about the politics and more about the science behind the coronavirus, The Guardian's Science Weekly team are producing special weekly episodes where you can hear experts who are working on the front line explore some of the listeners' most pressing questions. A huge thanks to our guests, Jennifer Rankin, Kate Proctor and Andrew Fisher. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Rowena Mason. Please take care and thanks for listening.